Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Sleepless Cinematic Podcast, where we explore our shared love for watching and discussing movies recorded in the late after-work hours, often in lieu of a good night's rest. I'm Emilio.
I'm Julian.
And I'm Madeline. And the three of us are colleagues at a Midtown Manhattan music school. Yes, music is what brings us together, but movies are what keep us together talking at the end of the night. So we've decided to create some order to this ongoing trend and record these conversations, considering an overarching theme while we cycle through five distinct, categorizable guidelines for engagement.
This podcast is an evolving thing. Changes and tweaks here and there will most likely happen. But while we do it, you, the listener, can count on the three of us doing what we've grown to love, foregoing sleep for a discussion about movies every other week.
And this week, we continue our current cycle of movies related to unique Best Picture Oscar winners with a category called Suggestion Box, where one of us elects a film for the group to discuss, and at least one of us will be seeing this movie for the very first time. And differing opinions may or may not be held among us. That is totally cool if they are, but we are here to explore those. The movie that we've decided to talk about today is definitely a classic. It is 1969's Midnight Cowboy, the John Schlesinger film it did indeed win Best Picture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Technically won in 1970 when the awards would have
happened.
But
the 1969 movies,
there we go.
Yeah, yes. The 1969 movies.
The ceremony was absolutely in 1970.
I always refer not to the year the ceremony's in, but to the year that the movies came out in.
Yeah, same that here. Makes sense.
I was just going to say, we have to be careful. We do not want to confuse this movie with Drugstore Cowboy, which is the Gus Van Sant film from 1989, starring Matt Dillon and Kelly Lynch, and a very early Heather Graham.
Also, do not want to confuse Midnight Cowboy with Urban Cowboy.
Oh, of course.
From, I think, 1980, starring John Travolta, and was it Deborah Winger?
Yeah, Deborah Winger, for sure.
Also, don't want to confuse it with Midnight Express.
Yeah, don't want that Alan Parker film. Very different.
Yeah, 1978. Yeah. Not to be confused with Midnight Run.
Oh, you took the words out of my mouth,
you guys,
man.
Just keep boom, boom.
I know. That's a good one, man. Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin. And I have a note about Charles Grodin in just a bit. But.
Oh, yeah. Also featuring our former close-up subject, Joey Pants.
Oh, of course. In a very classic role. Yeah. We also don't want to confuse this with the movie Midnight in Paris, which is, Woody Allen film from 2011, starring a whole slew of wonderful actors.
Yeah.
We're talking Midnight Cowboy.
Not Space Cowboys either.
Oh, dude, that movie's got a pretty stacked cast.
Yeah. Clint Eastwood,
James Garner,
Tommy Lee Jones.
Who's the fourth? Donald Sutherland.
Yes.
There you go. Yeah. Have you guys seen that movie?
No.
I have not. No.
I saw it a long time ago, and it's pretty fun. It's pretty fun, yeah. On the subject of Clint Eastwood, we should not also... this movie is not to be confused with Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is a movie that was directed by Clint Eastwood in 1997, 98. Mm. Also pretty stacked cast.
Also, maybe more of a stretch, but not to be confused with the Shakespeare play A Midsummer Night's Dream, or any filmic adaptation of it. Yes. Not to be confused with Ari Aster's Midsummer.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
So now just anything with mid in it is confusing.
Mid-90s? The Jonah Hill movie from a few years ago? No. Yeah. This is a decidedly Midnight Cowboy, right?
Right? Now I forgot.
Yeah. It's Midnight Cowboy.
Released in 1969, starring John Voight and Dustin Hoffman.
Yes.
They're billed opposite.
Yeah, because Dustin Hoffman had a little more cachet at that time.
That's true.
Because of The Graduate.
Although supposedly he was cast in this before The Graduate came out, which is, I think, very interesting.
Yeah.
Is that so?
It was because of a Broadway play that he was in, I think that was called A.
A Canadian?
Come again? What?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a play called A that he was in.
Oh,
and
are you saying egg?
With no. Okay, E-H with an exclamation point.
Because then I suddenly started hearing egg.
No, not egg. Okay. But A. Yes, with the stereotypically Canadian phrase. Yes.
Okay. Not like A-Y-E?
No.
No.
But so he was in this play, A, and Jerome Hellman, who produced Midnight Cowboy, saw him and thought he was born to play Ratso Rizzo.
Oh, interesting. There's some story out there that he actually organized some meeting with somebody in casting and set it up so that he knew the route that they were going to walk to this meeting, and then actually like pester them on the street as being a vagrant of some kind, and then at the last minute be like, hey, it's me. This is what I've
interesting.
Heard.
I feel like this is maybe the same story that I've heard, and that he like really greases himself up for this and gets very scruffy. Like
The story that I read in Michael Shulman's Oscar Wars was that, I mean, that book has a great chapter about Midnight Cowboy and the year it's released, by the way. And the story that, as it's told there, is that Dustin Hoffman had been in consideration since before The Graduate was released, but John Schlesinger had second thoughts about casting him after The Graduate because he thought, I think, that he was a little too clean cut from The Graduate.
He is he's very pretty in The Graduate, and they manage, I think, because of the teeth, to like really make him not pretty in this. I find young Dustin Hoffman so pretty to look at, but not in this movie.
No, definitely not. No. I actually heard that John Voight, on the subject of the teeth, I heard that John Voight apparently saw him like put them in, or like had he went to some dentist and had something fixed up for himself. And he said that he was actually jealous of the teeth because he felt like it was this extra thing that helped him get into character. And he's like, oh my God, this guy is killing it. I don't know. We'll just kind of jump right in, right?
Yeah, let's jump in. I just want to say that, I mean, yeah, Dustin Hoffman gets fake teeth, but John Voight gets a cowboy hat. Most of the movie. So.
Boots. He's got that like frilly kind of like jacket.
Great jacket. Yeah. Like, and great. Every shirt he wears is really, really excellent. I think beautiful embroidery.
Yeah, I think all of those shirts like would... You could kind of go to like a Bushwick like thrift store and you'd find a bunch of them.
L-Train Vintage.
And
to see all of the, you know, today's Midnight Cowboys walking on the street in present day New York. I was also just thinking about John Voight that, you know, you would, you know, watching Midnight Cowboy, you might not know this, but he is from Yonkers, New York.
I read that. I didn't know that necessarily, but I've listened to him speak, just John Voight, the man, you know, not acting or embodying a character. He sounds like he could be really from kind of anywhere, United States.
You lent me the Criterion Blu-ray of this movie, and right after watching the movie, I watched the interview, one of the interviews with him, and I was very struck by the stark difference in his voice.
Yeah, I mean,
after listening to this accent for 2 hours.
Sure. Apparently, you know, one of the things that was kind of cool, Dustin Hoffman was on record saying that, you know, there's a little bit of this connection between The Graduate and this film, partially because of the star system in Hollywood at the time, right? Graduate came out 2 years before, made Dustin Hoffman sort of like overnight, and kind of made him this household name. And this movie is decidedly very different. But apparently both of these films had a pretty long pre-production kind of schedule, and both of them had, I think, 3 or 4 weeks of pretty extensive rehearsals with just the actors and then some of the principal kind of photography director, some of the main principals, kind of camera people, so that they could sort of figure out how to light certain actors. The writer Waldo Salt was also really heavily involved in these rehearsals, but these rehearsals apparently were a really big place where the John Voight and Dustin Hoffman in particular were really able to flesh out Joe Buck and, you know, Rico. We'll call him Rico, right? We'll give him some respect.
That's his preference.
Put some respect on his name.
And Rico Salvatore Rizzo.
There we go. but they really were able to kind of flesh out those characters and kind of live in them for a little bit, you know? John Voight was able to get jealous of some fake teeth, you know, because they were really trying to like one up one another, I think, in this rehearsal process. Like, bring their like best version of themselves.
I imagine both of them are like that in general.
Yeah.
You know, they're both not individually from the places that their characters are from in the movie.
Yeah, Hoffman's LA, right?
Yeah, Hoffman's from LA. So they had to spend time in those locations studying like the looks and the accents of people who live there.
Okay, so I'd seen this movie before.
I had seen this movie before too.
Madeline? I had not. I'm the one that has not seen it. I think I was just like vaguely familiar with the premise of this movie and just kind of never got around to it. So I'm thrilled to have finally been initiated.
Yeah.
This was is actually kind of an interesting movie for me because I had a really notable first time watching this, which was the very first movie that I saw in the very first class, in the very first screening that I had when I was in film school. Intro to cinema studies, and this was like the very first one where like, okay, we're gonna sit down and we're gonna see something that will be representative, mm-hmm. I think, of what might have brought you to this class.
And what did you learn from this movie?
Well, I'll say this, that I remember seeing it and actually, I remember thinking it was good. I remember thinking that it was like, it was definitely an experience. I think there were a couple moments where I got a little bit lost, and I think some of the visual storytelling in this film, I wasn't totally on board with at the time.
At the time, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking it was pretty good, and I remember thinking there was some very memorable things about this movie. Fast forward, it's been almost 20 years now. You alluded to the fact that I lent you a Criterion Blu-ray of this. On a whim, was like, we're going to watch this. I'm going to buy this on Blu-ray. Yeah. I'm going to assume I'm going to like this movie enough to want to keep it. I had spent a little bit of time in the last 3 or 4 years digging into some of John Schlesinger's earlier films, and I was super in on them. And so it was very cool for me to revisit this movie after having seen Billy Liar, Darling, and Far From the Madding Crowd. They are superb films. He is a really, really interesting director. I will probably gush about him a little bit in a moment. And I actually, looking back on it, I think this is a really great movie. Obviously, late 60s, you know, we're coming up on this kind of American new wave, like the independent film scene in the United States was really just sort of taking off. This movie, along with like Easy Rider, I think two 1969 kind of classic films that really, I think, rewrote the rules on what we could see in movies. Mm-hmm. And on top of just like thematically and also just historically where it's placed, I think that this movie just has such an incredible visual style. It's a really, really immersive experience watching this movie.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. And, you know, in reference to like that group of movies that heralded the beginning of the new Hollywood era, I think it often comes down when people narrow it down to like four movies, they'll say, this is one of them and Easy Rider is another. And then they'll go back to two earlier movies, which are The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde.
Right, mm-hmm. From 67.
To bring it back to Midnight Cowboy, of that group of four, I think that, you know, having now seen all of them, I felt this way for a while, but this has only affirmed my feeling. I think Midnight Cowboy is my favorite of that bunch.
Interesting.
Yeah, all great movies, but I think something about this one just really, really hits me.
Cool. I've seen all four of them too.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen all four of them?
I've only seen this and The Graduate.
Okay. If I had to rank them, I would put Easy Rider last. And then I would put Bonnie and Clyde, then I would put Midnight Cowboy, and then I'd put The Graduate.
So The Graduate is your number one.
Is my number one. Yeah. Yes, yeah. The Graduate is like an absolute masterpiece of like of formal and kind of like modern directing style. Mike Nichols totally hits it out of the park.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a strong recommendation for The Graduate. Yeah. Not taking anything away from this film, because Midnight Cowboy is also pretty sensational.
And my first experience with Midnight Cowboy was, it was not, you know, in anything like, you know, cinema studies at college. It was just something that I casually watched with my parents one day about 6.5 years ago. And this, you know,
I love that you specify it was 6.5 years ago. Yeah. That's just something that I like about how your brain works.
Oh, thank you.
Very specific.
Admittedly, it's pretty convenient to have that kind of memory for dates, but it helps with the letterbox to count a lot. But it was something because, like, worth noting, my parents are among the people who until the bitter end, we're getting DVDs in the mail from Netflix.
My parents too.
Yes. Yeah. Hell yes.
We were like very, like pretty early DVD Netflix subscribers. Yeah. Like my uncle, I think like late 90s was like, you guys have to get in on this. This is the next big thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm fairly sure they were getting them until last year when it stopped.
Yeah.
Mom, please text me and confirm that.
Yeah. I literally like the last, for the last DVD in the mail that we received, I like took a ceremonial picture of it. Nice. It's just like, wow. End of an
what
era.
What DVD was it?
It was, okay, so do you both know the movie The Worst Person in the World?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it yet.
It's an interesting movie. Yeah. I liked it. It was good.
I did too. It's not that movie, but one by the same director. I think you say his name like Joachim Trier.
That sounds right.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's an earlier movie of his called Oslo, August 31st.
Okay.
Part of number two in the Oslo trilogy, of which Worst Person in the World is number three. But that was the last DVD in the mail from Netflix. But Midnight Cowboy, the first time I saw it was in that format.
Very cool.
And yeah. I think like I didn't do too much to comprehend it at the time, but it stuck with me as like, yeah, this is amazing. I see why it won Best Picture. I think it's an amazing document of its time. It's very, you know, progressive. I mean, you know, some things are surely dated about it, but even by today's standards, I think it still holds up as a really engaging movie.
I think this has aged spectacularly well, yeah. Which if I remember correctly, like Roger Ebert was pretty harsh on this movie, I think. And I think so. I believe that one of the things he said was that he felt like it was not going to like stand the test of time.
Although, he was not always right.
Yeah.
You know, he was a wonderful writer, and I think his spirit as a critic, I think, is something that a lot of critics should aspire towards. But yeah, he wasn't always right.
Yeah, and this is an example where he was not.
Although Gene Siskel, to the contrary, said, maybe this is retrospective, but I cannot recall a more marvelous pair of acting performances in any one film.
That's true. And actually, I feel like Ebert also spoke pretty highly of the performances and just mm-hmm. like really did not like the directing.
You know, you were saying like you in watching it were like, I can totally see how this movie won Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I think when this movie came out, it was pretty shocking.
Yeah, oh, yeah,
it
definitely.
Was not a slam dunk necessarily, even though I think it was a pretty big cultural moment. I think mm-hmm. it definitely made quite an impression on mainstream America and filmgoers. I mean, the movie did very well. It was a very mm-hmm. successful film.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think thematically, this movie shows a lot and touches on, I think, a lot of things that I don't think was very commonly shown in films at
oh,
the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and yet its X rating feels like a little too much.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely by today's standards.
Yeah. But even like we think about, this isn't the first X-rated movie that we've covered because we talked several John Waters Divine movies from that time.
And Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So it's like, I think that this is maybe the most tame of all the X-rated movies that we've talked about.
I would say so too.
Yeah.
You look at this compared to Pink Flamingos and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's shocking that they're rated the same.
Although yeah. I think around a year after Midnight Cowboy was released, there was an appeal made mm-hmm. to the rating system to change its rating to R, and it was changed without a single frame being altered.
Exactly. Wow. Because I think from my understanding, it was originally rated R, not before the release, but mm-hmm. upon its sort of first, just like the initial review from the MPAA, it was rated as R. And then a psychiatrist like appealed this essentially and is like, this movie has homosexual themes that are going to, you know, negatively influence the children of America or whatever, some kind of bullshit like that.
Yeah.
And they bump it up to X and then they bump it back down after it does so well at the Oscars, is my understanding. Correct me if I got any of that wrong.
No, I actually don't know too much about the history, but Julian, you have your finger up and a book out.
Yeah. So there's actually a pretty clear breakdown of this in Oscar Wars. And so I'm going to quote directly from the book. Under the new rating system, United Artists chairman Arthur Krim was certain that Midnight Cowboy would be the first studio movie to be branded with a Scarlet X. When the ratings board gave it an R, he should have been thrilled. More papers could advertise it, and more audiences could buy tickets. Instead, he rejected the rating and pushed for the X. He was worried about the movie's influence on children. Could it turn them gay? Besides, he realized, the X would give Midnight Cowboy cachet with the hippie crowd. The quality was there. No question. I was sure Hoffman and Voight would be Academy Award nominees, UA executive Gabe Sumner recalled. The question was how to make the movie more potentially exciting to the general public. I felt the controversy over the X rating would give it an extra dimension. The movie needed to get out of the art house and into the public square.
Wow, that's really interesting. I mean, and it's even, I mean, this predates even, I think, some of the kind of more famous, like, adult X-rated films, like Deep Throat.
Yeah,
Or even by like a couple of years.
Clockwork Orange, too.
Clockwork Orange, yeah.
Yeah. Or, yeah, any of the John Waters movies.
Yeah, but just to think that an X rating would give a film cachet,
you know,
that's kind of where I'm thinking. Like,
and this is before the PG-13 rating exists, though.
Oh, definitely.
At all, yeah.
That was 1984.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember once at, like, a some kind of social gathering in high school, there was, like, a game of Truth or Dare happening where someone said, let's keep it PG, but then another person said, well, let's make it like a 1970s PG, though.
Yeah, ooh, I like that. That's
definitely
good.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you might have, I don't know, some... You might have an F-bomb or two.
Yeah, I mean, like the Goonies or even Annie. They, like, drop a goddamn in Annie, like Tim Curry does. And it's, like, really shocking.
I'm trying to think. There are definitely some PG movies from the 70s that have the F-bomb.
Yeah.
There definitely are. I'm sure somebody online has,
compiled a list.
Yeah, that there's a list, and maybe someone has even found the PG movie that has like three F-bombs or something. Yeah. We all have grown up in the age of PG-13, I think, where there was a very clear delineation where you could say, okay, this isn't quite reaching, you know, our territory, but yeah. Did I ever tell you guys about how I'm talking a lot about my very first semester of college, but I took an honor seminar with a guy named Richard Hefner, who is a total G, by the way. You can Google this guy. He's like an institution. It's crazy. He had a show on PBS called The Open Mind, and it ran for years and years and years. And this guy actually was the head of the ratings board between, oh my God, I'm trying to think, maybe like late 70s into the early 90s. And so he is responsible for the PG-13 rating. And he even talked a little bit about it in one of our classes. Yeah. I couldn't get too much out of it because he was like, we need to put our focus back on Billy Budd, was what we were reading at the time.
A curriculum to get through.
Exactly. Yeah. We can't sit here and appease all of your weird film nerdy interests. And I remember I met with him during office hours, and he was like, the coolest guy ever.
Yeah,
he was so incredible. So I shout out to Richard Hefner. I know he has a son who I think is still very prominent in the film industry. He passed away about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. But good memories. Richard Hefner, thank you for PG-13. As it has kind of, I don't know, it's created this weird sort of spectrum of like where, you know, content sits.
Yeah, because there are certain things now that we think about, like the stereotype of if a movie has this thing, it has to fall into this category. Like if like there's a cigarette, like that's like an automatic R,
maybe, or maybe it's at least not PG.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like at least a PG-13 now if there's a cigarette. And I think even like with PG-13, you maybe get like one F-bomb, like one non-sexual F-bomb.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Just one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that there's like a blood cutoff too, where I think that if you show a certain amount of blood, that makes it an R.
Certain number of gallons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, I mean, it comes down to these little things that feel ridiculous when you describe them, but that is the rating system.
Yeah. And I mean, it was certainly in place and something for this movie to contend with when it was looking for a wider distribution. But
yeah,
it seems oddly enough, like it really wasn't a hindrance.
But speaking of ratings and the context into which Midnight Cowboy emerges, the winner of Best Picture at the previous Academy Awards was Oliver, which I think to date is the only G-rated movie to win Best Picture.
I thought about Oliver when watching this movie.
Really?
I did, because I was like, Rico is like kind of like the Artful Dodger.
Oh, that's a really interesting comparison. Yeah, yeah, I like that.
Well, the Artful Dodger, I mean, there was a screenplay that Waldo Salt was writing before Midnight Cowboy that was called The Artful Dodger.
Yeah. He's got a really fascinating history. Apparently, he was blacklisted in the 50s and kind of made his way sort of back into the film industry, you know, by the 60s. But this was a real moment for him.
Yeah.
You know, him, working on this. And I should be able to tell you if he won for best screenplay.
He did.
He did. Good.
Yeah. Thank you. But yeah, I mean, I think this really kind of cemented his reemergence in Hollywood.
Yeah, because he wins again for Coming Home.
Right, which is...
A few years later.
Have you guys seen that movie?
No.
Oh, that's a real good one.
When you look at the Oscars, the 42nd Academy Awards, when Midnight Cowboy won the top prize, it's interesting as kind of a look at the old versus the new guard of Hollywood at the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the context of these very progressive wins for Midnight Cowboy in the Best Picture, adapted screenplay, and direction categories, you have a lot of these like dyed-in-the-wool Hollywood icons still winning awards. I mean, the biggest contradiction is John Wayne winning Best Actor for True Grit.
Oh, for sure.
John Wayne, who is poked fun at in Midnight Cowboy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. That's a great point, though. You're right. Like, this is a real kind of turning point. I think you even see it in some of the Best Picture films as well.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, you've got, you know, Hello, Dolly and Anne of a Thousand Days, which are period pieces, musicals. I mean, those are kind of, that's typical, you know, Oscar kind of catnip from years back. But you've also got Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know, which I think is an extremely modern film in its construction. And also the kind of Paul Newman, Robert Redford of it all, I think, signals a very kind of different, kind of more modern type of relationship that an audience would have with like leading man, you know, movie stars.
Yeah. And in fact, there's a comparison drawn in Oscar Wars between that and Midnight Cowboy with the two, you know, two male friends at the center. You really do see the duality in that year's Academy Awards nominees and winners. And, you know, it's worth noting, too, that John Wayne beat both John Voight and Dustin Hoffman in the same category.
Yeah. It might have split the vote.
Yeah, that was my thought as well. I also heard that Fred Astaire performs at this ceremony.
Mm-hmm. He performed.
Like, does a dance performance. It feels like that would be something from a completely different time period.
Yeah, from the late 40s or something. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that Bob Hope was the host that year, and he's one of those...
He is. Yeah. When you talk about dyed in the wool.
Yeah.
I think, how many Oscars did he...
Let's see if Wikipedia can
answer
that.
He's got to have the record. I think for a long time, that was his gig.
Yeah. 19 times he hosted the Academy Awards.
And is that the record? Who would even be close to that?
Billy Crystal, I think,
won a bunch. But it's still the record, yeah. Okay. But yeah, the tried and true Bob Hope was the host at this ceremony. And like, I believe there were some, you know, conservative remarks that he made about the sea change happening in Hollywood at that time. The Bob Hope speech is, "Never again will Hollywood be accused of showing a lollipop world. Perhaps by showing the nitty-gritty, by giving the world a glimpse of the element of violence and its destructive effect, it will help cool it. Whatever violence the screen has shown is not an example to follow, but to see in its full destructive power. The troubled, kooky characters that people, the screens, are not examples to emulate, but to learn from and try to understand and hopefully perhaps contrive help for. More and more films have explored the broad spectrum of human experience. They have fearlessly, and for the most part with excellent taste, examined behavior long considered taboo." And that was what he said at the end of that ceremony.
Wait, that's how he ended it?
Yeah, according to this book.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, I think a perfectly good argument can be made for how this was a real flashpoint moment in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. I think like in our podcast too, this might break the record for the most said about the movie's context before we get into the thing itself.
I was just about to say,
But one other production detail that I think you'll both get a kick out of. There were some whispers, according to, I think, Michael Childers, who was the longtime partner
of Schlesinger,
that he told a story that there was some interest expressed in the part of Joe Buck by the agent of Elvis Presley.
Wow.
I mean, I also thought about Elvis a little bit watching this movie.
There was no real consideration of actually having him in that role.
Well, no, I mean, Elvis, he acted in a lot of movies. Yeah. He was not a good actor. He never wanted to be an actor. Yeah.
I can only imagine Dustin Hoffman just getting exasperated having to have 3 or 4 weeks of rehearsals with Elvis as opposed to someone like John Voight.
Yeah. But anyway, moving on from Elvis. Yeah. So content.
Content. You know, maybe this is one way to start talking about it, but you know, you made a reference even just talking about the 1970 Oscars
celebrating films ceremony. From 1969.
Thank you. Yes. That John Wayne actually won Best Actor, but that in this film, he's sort of mocked a little bit. And I think that that's another really interesting, take on this. And when we start talking about content, that's one of the characteristics about Joe Buck, the main character, is he, you know, he's assuming this role. He is from Texas. He's kind of a young guy. He's a dishwasher who, has dreams of being basically like a male gigolo, like a hustler. And he, in his mind, thinks there are a lot of rich women on the Upper East and Upper West Side who are willing to, take a ride with me or take a spin in bed or whatever. And so, he makes his way up to New York City. And he very quickly realizes that the image of a cowboy is very different in this day and age in this particular city, and that it does not really carry with it all of the kind of typical masculine markers. I think that he grew up with as a kid, or that he saw, amongst his grandmother's sort of lovers. Mm-hmm. And so there's this really interesting sort of play within the film, I think, that's also talking about this kind of change in perception of, what is masculine, what is sexy, what is attractive, to a woman.
But even in Texas, like at the very beginning when he's donning this attire, it feels like he's wearing a costume. Like at times, even down there, like we see some flashbacks with the grandmother's like lover in a cowboy hat or like riding a horse or whatever, but generally when the brief amount of time when we see him walking around, we see him go to the diner, we see him on the bus, nobody else is dressed like this. Like even down there, it's an exaggerated costume.
He gets on a like a Greyhound bus, and there's that moment where there are two women who kind of start giggling at him. Mm-hmm. And in his mind, he's like, oh man, they must think I'm such a stud. But it's very possible that they're just like, dude, what is this guy wearing? And that's, I think, one of the things that unfortunately, happens right away we see with this character is that he...
There's a disconnect.
There's a very real disconnect. And this is another, I think, way to start talking about the absolutely wonderful theme song to this film.
Oh gosh, it's so good.
It's so good. But the lyrics of that song, like very clearly reflect, this idea. It says everybody talking at me, only echoes of my mind. Where it's like, this guy is just, he's in his own head, so much. And those lyrics and that song, they're just a beautiful evocation of what we see early in the film, which is that Joe Buck, he's a guy who's built himself up with voices in his own head. He's constructed this fantasy life, and he's going off to a place where, the weather will suit his clothes.
Yeah. And even in spite of, these deterrents he's seeing pretty immediately, he is unaffected by it. And that, it's reflected well, I think, by the chorus of the song where it's, I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain.
Right.
It's just, it's a very sunny chorus. In spite of, the awkwardness and discomfort that's connoted by the verses.
Yeah. And I will also just say one other thing, which is, I think, just from a kind of a theory standpoint, we are music.
Yes.
Musicians. We're music teachers here. This song, the kind of main groove of it really toggles between E major and E major 7. And I cannot think of a song that better balances the kind of tonal texture of those chords, like what they represent, because major obviously is the gold standard of like stability, right? And major 7 chords are like have that stability, but there's this there's this kind of like wistfulness to it, you know, when you hear that one note. It's like, you know, a major seven is so close to the octave, but not quite. I just think that it's such a beautiful metaphor for the, not just Joe Buck, but for Rico Rizzo, you know, those two characters' relationship, you know, to one another, and then their relationship to the rest of the world, which is that they're just, you know, they don't quite fit, but that there's also something optimistic about like their cores. I don't know.
Particularly Joe.
Particularly Joe. Yeah. I would say that even though Rico, I think, deals with some maladies throughout the film, I think, you know, he, even in his very last, spoiler alert, in his very last breaths, I think he is thinking that he is still going to make it to Florida.
And
we'll get into more of that later. But I mean, this song is just so good. And I even, you know, when we put it on and the movie starts, it's like, where's that Joe Buck? Where? And then he has that moment where, you know, the camera whip pans towards the mirror. And just when that song hits, like, we feel like we're getting shot out of a cannon.
Yeah,
it's so
really
good.
Really excellent needle drop, like all-timer needle drop. And I mean, great song in general, like originally like written by Fred Neil but performed by Henry Nilsson, this version. I mean, there have been countless covers of this song by, you know, Stevie Wonder,
Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
That's a great one. Yeah. Iggy Pop. Leonard Nimoy does a version of this song.
What?
So
that's
like
kind of cool.
Monotone or something?
No. He actually has some music out.
Nice.
Check it out. Make your own opinions.
I was going to say really quick, too. I got a chance to listen to a little bit of the director commentary. And Schlesinger says that, you know, he was recommended this song, I think, by a friend. The Harry Nilsson version of this song predates the film, I think, by about 18 months or so when it was released. And so he liked it a lot, and he used it as part of the rough cut to the film that was being shown to the studio execs and the producers. And everyone kind of liked the song, but he said that a lot of them felt like, you know what, we could probably hire somebody to do something really similar and then not have to pay for the rights of the song. And apparently they tried, and they really shipped it around, and they tried really hard. Apparently Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, who are like heavy hitters in the folk world at this time, were also brought in, according to the director. And just none of them could get anything that was sounding better than this. There's real magic in a bottle on this song. So, you know, he said that he kept it all the way up until the very kind of like final cuts. And apparently the studio executives were just like, this has just got to be it.
I mean, on Wikipedia, it says that Bob Dylan wrote Lay Lady Lay to serve as the theme, but he just didn't finish it in time.
Oh, interesting.
And I mean, it's just interesting to imagine that like Bob Dylan's version probably would have been a little too rough. Like, everybody's talking at me. Can't hear a word they're saying. But then like Joni Mitchell's might have been a little too flowery.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't get your Joni Mitchell impression. We only get your Bob Dylan impression.
I don't have the vocal range to do that.
That's okay. Yeah. That's totally fair. I was going to say, you know, Bob Dylan's voice sounds absolutely perfect for the beginning of Big Lebowski. And I don't think it would have worked for this one. It was funny because this song, you know, I obviously, watching the film, I had it in my head a bunch, and I got it in my wife's head. And my wife was talking about, she's like, God, I really wish I could yodel, you know, because this song has like a little bit of yodeling. And my wife has worked very hard to work through her break. And so she's like, yodeling, it just, I can't really do it. She's like, the song makes me want to yodel.
I mean, there's like the part that's like, wah, 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 wah. Does that count as yodeling?
I think it's later and goes like, I'm not going to impersonate right now, but there you go. That's it.
You know, to say a little more about the use of music in this movie, I mean, I think you see it in a lot of new Hollywood movies where there will kind of just be one song that they keep on using throughout the movie. And I think this is, well, I mean, you've seen it kind of before with The Graduate.
Oh,
with
Sounds of Silence,
Sound of Silence and a bunch of Simon and Garfunkel songs in that
Scarborough
movie.
Scarborough Fair.
Yeah, that one too. Mrs. Robinson, which I think is written for the movie.
Of course.
And then, like, but you see it later on too. Like, I already mentioned Harold and Maude. Like, there's
if you
a song.
Want to sing out? Sing
yeah,
out?
It's such a delightful song.
Oh, the best,
That, like, I mean, it's not really with pop songs, but A Clockwork Orange kind of does it too with the Wendy Carlos music.
And a certain Gene Kelly song film.
Oh, yeah.
Or a song song, I should say.
I mean, I think technically they only dropped the needle once. The other two times, it's Malcolm McDowell singing it on the spot.
Right, right. We were talking about the clash of old Hollywood and new Hollywood, and I have to imagine that another shining example of that was Gene Kelly's absolute disdain for The Clockwork Orange. Apparently, he was almost ready to go to blows with people related, you know, who worked on that film for what it did to that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everybody's talking. It's one of the great examples of a new Hollywood use of music and just one of the best needle drops ever in film history.
Really, really good.
One of the greatest opening songs, too, not to mention. It's like, you know, not only as a needle drop, but as a song to start the movie.
And it comes back very close to the end. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't end on it, but I think they play it again maybe as he's buying clothes when they get to Florida.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. When he's,
But
I was just going to say that, I mean, talking about the music in this film, the score is also really great. I mean, particularly like his kind of nightmarish sequences, like are always scored really well. Like, I don't remember which one that that starts with the like,
the like spy music almost.
I love
that scene because it almost looks, again, to tying back a little bit to the Joe Buck's sort of inner voices and stuff. Like, I love that scene because it is very much like he's the hero in his own film.
Yeah.
Who's like, you know, getting into the subway and he's tracking down the guy who did him wrong. Yeah. And I love that, that music sort of has that vibe of like, you know, he's a secret agent who's going to get the bad guy. Yeah.
And the main score is composed by John Barry, and then the main theme music, it's composed by John Barry, but harmonica is played by Toots Thielemann.
Great name.
And that that theme too, alongside Everybody's Talking, that's a really great piece of music as well.
It really is. I think it does a lot of the work that I think that kind of major seven kind of toggle does, where it sounds wistful, it sounds somewhat optimistic, but there's something very like sorrowful in a harmonica. There's just like the very last breaths that you're going to take, it sort of has a little bit of that feel too. I think we can definitely say, man, the score of this film is, I think, one of the aspects that really, I think, adds tremendously to the viewing experience.
And I think that also just to make a very music nerdy comment, that score is a great use of the Neapolitan chord as well.
Right
towards the end, like the da, 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 as yeah, that's yep. happening.
Yes, true, yeah. true, true.
Like, and while we're still in this opening sequence, just one thing I want to say that doesn't really have to do with the music is just those opening frames. Even it's always struck me as kind of a meta commentary. Because
I love it.
You see this like drive-in movie screen that's zoomed out from as Joe Buck is, you know, singing in the shower, and you know it's audio at first. You don't see him immediately, and I just have to wonder if that's like an intentional way of like, it's like viewing Hollywood as a clean slate that this is coming into,
or like
some commentary on the past, on like the Western genre.
Sure. Okay. I mean, one of the things I definitely like about that. I mean, I will maybe use this as an opportunity to dig a little deeper into my love for John Schlesinger. Mm-hmm. He's just a very witty director. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times he has a really keen eye for like a really impressionistic like shot. Mm-hmm. And this is a perfect example of it. You know, it's, I also, you know, was really struck by it too when I was watching it. And I think one of the things that's funny about this drive-in theater is, you know, you're seeing it during the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even the most successful bustling drive-in theater looks like a ghost town during the day. And like you said, there might be some, you know, undertones about, you know, the direction of Hollywood, or maybe kind of like how films commercially are about to sort of change a little bit. But that, you know, the drive-in theater looks like a ghost town in a lot of ways. That is how Joe Buck feels about where he's living now.
Yeah.
You know, he feels very much like there's nothing else here for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of a, like a dead end place where his insecurities and his immaturities and maybe some of his demons are really keeping him from living a fulfilling life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also worth noting in the, you know, in the meta elements of this scene that, like, you know, those first shots of his coworkers saying, "Where's that Joe Buck?" I'm like, he's not in the room with them. It's just stuff that they're saying out to thin air, supposedly. And then when he is, you know, shown as basically responding to them, he's talking straight into the camera.
Totally. That's
right before that whip pan into the mirror happens.
Yeah, I like that sequence a lot because he's also like, he's fantasizing about going there and quitting his job. Mm. Like, he's like, oh, you know, you can take those dishes and you know where to shove them and I can help if I forget exactly.
Yeah.
But then he gets there and he's like, oh, sir, I wanted to pick up my paycheck and, you know, I won't be heading on east. Like, he's so timid when he actually is
absolutely
confronted with this situation that he's been fantasizing about at home.
Yeah, the cinematographer, Adam Hollander, he mentioned that the presence of mirrors was really important in the film, that it was very much a place where, you know, the inner life of Joe Buck was going to come out, whether it was some more like aspirational characteristic of his personality or if it was, you know, self-consciousness about himself as well. So that's a perfectly good, you know, a representation of that, right?
He's
talking a big game to himself and then it's just like, hey, you know, I'm going to go. Hey, can I get my paycheck?
Yeah. I have a slightly off-topic question. How tall do you guys think John Boyd is?
6'3".
Yeah, I think that...
that's my guess.
I read somewhere that he's like 6'2 or 3.
He's 6'2". Yeah. I looked this up, but I just feel like because Dustin Hoffman is so small, I think he's 5'5".
Mm-hmm.
He looks like... John Voight looks gigantic.
Yeah, they said something too about when they were filming this, Adam Hollander talked about how he was tall enough that they were able to shoot him from like a few blocks away with just like a long telescopic lens just above like a general kind of height, and you could just see him. There's a pretty memorable shot of the film where you see him and you can see his head and his cowboy hat just cruising along.
That's a classic shot, but it is so interesting because it's like, it's not like 6'2 is one of those heights where you like wouldn't encounter another 6'2 person on the street if you were walking in a crowd that big. Like, I feel like they probably had to weed out some background actors for that, like
possibly
6 feet and below. Julian, how tall are you?
I am like just shy of exactly 6 feet.
Okay.
I'm like 5'11 and a half.
See, I'm only 5'2, so you guys both seem tall. I'm like, is one of you 6'2?
No, I'm not 6'2. I'm probably right around you. I think I've been to the doctor before and I've measured at 6 feet.
Mm.
So I've stuck with that.
I think I'm 6 feet with shoes on.
There we go.
That's me too.
I was wondering if, I mean, he also has those boots. I feel like those add a couple inches, which I think is helpful. But I mean, the shot that you're alluding to, Dustin Hoffman also does in Tootsie.
Yes.
That same shot, like walking down the street.
Right.
Crowded. Yeah.
Right. But the kind
very
of.
Very different.
Yeah. Very different. And what is kind of exceptional about him is
not
his physicality in terms of height, but like like how he's transformed himself, you know?
Yeah.
Another banger of a movie.
Oh, yeah.
I've actually never seen that.
That's a great one.
That movie.
We should talk about that movie.
You know what? I think we should too.
And so now before that much of the movie's runtime has happened, Joe Buck has come to New York. But, you know, before we get all the way into the New York chapter, I love that bus ride that he takes.
Great bus ride. I mean, as someone, I didn't grow up in Texas, but I grew up in North Carolina. I lived there until like my mid-20s, and rural North Carolina is not all that dissimilar from rural Texas, I would assume. And it felt like this beginning sequence felt so authentic to me, like in a lot of ways. Like the woman with the child that like asks him for gum, her reaction when he tells her he's going to New York City.
She kind of is like, that's cute.
I have received that exact same reaction when I told people I was moving to New York City, when I tell people I live in New York City, I get that same reaction often.
I remember actually that moment very vividly because he's like, where are you going to? And she's like, Dallas.
Yeah.
Again, keeping it real close.
Local.
You know, yeah, I came very local there. But
I
gotta say though, I don't know if Joe Buck would have been a particularly awesome companion.
He's got that damn radio.
Yeah.
I mean, don't know, man. That's like a real strike against you if you're on public transportation.
I legitimately watched this and I'm like, need to Google when were headphones invented?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I think the other writers, the nuns too, I think would have appreciated that. I actually really like to how he first is introduced to New York. It's through that radio.
Yeah.
You know, it dials in and he's like, hey, I'm here.
And you can see like the Statue of Liberty in the distance, mm-hmm. out the bus window, yeah, at that moment.
Yeah.
And that moment is also really telling too. I mean, you know, so much of this movie is about what is going on in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Schlesinger just kind of gives you that montage of, you know, and we don't even know really if that's what's happening on the radio, but in his mind,
yeah,
he is like, he's thinking he's listening to like a radio show, like a call-in show or something where women are talking about, you know, what they desire in men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and he's like, he is just like licking his lips and just can't wait to, you know, unleash himself.
Yeah.
Upon the female population of New York City.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, but
and,
it's...
And also it's, the first example that like on that radio, maybe this is in his mind, maybe it's, yeah, a real call-in show. The first lady says she wants Gary Cooper, but he's already dead.
Right.
So when we're
strong,
talking about
silent
Oscar...
Type.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about Oscar winners.
Yeah.
But it's just so funny. Like, I mean, I've made a lot of Sopranos anecdotes, but I'm going to make another one.
The Gary Cooper line?
Yeah, the strong silent type.
Yeah.
It's just so funny that that's what Tony Soprano's ideal of a man is too.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that for many people, I think so, like Gary Cooper was like an ideal. An ideal.
Realistically, I think that Joe Buck is in New Jersey when that comes on the radio too.
Maybe he's passing
that's
through.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Got myself a gun. He's passing through the toll booth.
Yeah, there's an alternate version of this where you just have the Sopranos theme playing in that scene.
Yeah,
that's the everybody's talking.
Yeah. Or it's Tony Soprano's voice coming through the radio, and it's a flipped gender.
Oh yeah,
and it's, what do men want to be?
Well, another thing I love about that bus ride, though, is, you know, these kind of interludes of his own memories, mm-hmm. particularly of his grandmother and of his ex-girlfriend, Crazy Annie.
Crazy yeah. Annie,
who yeah. is played by Jennifer Salt, daughter of Waldo Salt.
Which is
that's like a crazy role to write that you probably were not picturing your daughter.
Yeah,
and she, very true.
And there are some later scenes, which I'm sure we'll get into, that also depict her that she said she was traumatized by while filming.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
I listened to an interview where she talked a little bit about, you know, that character, because it's, again, it's, you see these glimpses and these, you know, quick shots, and you hear her voice very memorably saying over and over, at least Joe Buck is remembering over and over, her saying, you know, you're the only one,
Joe.
Exactly, yeah. And apparently, you know, her read on the character was that she was sort of like the town floozy, mm-hmm. and that she went out with a lot of guys, and that for whatever reason, Joe Buck remembers that he was special in her eyes, and mm-hmm. that his kind of simple thinking, you know, imagining that there was this woman who got around a lot, who saw some value in him, chose him, kind of, you know, pumped him up even more.
Yeah. And in some ways, I mean, later you get a line of like, the only thing I've ever been good for is loving. And I would imagine that what you're saying, that would totally give you the impression where you're like, I've had this tough life. Nobody's ever really seen me, but this lady that I hooked up with, like, said I was special. So that's what I'm good at.
Kind of reminds me a little bit of Dirk Diggler in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Everyone has one special
I definitely
trait.
Thought that's another movie that I thought about and another character. Yeah.
Interesting.
That
yeah, I think for sure.
You can definitely draw a parallel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought was interesting too about like that, you know, the images you see in Joe Buck's mind in that bus ride is that even though he's kind of, you know, trying to live up to what he sees as these masculine ideals, that he seems to be shaped by feminine presences a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that other than his grandmother's boyfriend, I don't know that he's ever really had like a male presence.
Right. Mm-hmm. A father figure.
Yeah.
You see him palling around with other guys.
Like some guys.
But
yeah.
those guys also seem to be pretty
not
awful.
Good friends.
Yeah, pretty awful later.
Yeah.
for whatever reason, and I think that's, you know, to your point, you know, that that bus ride is really pivotal.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, this is based on a book.
Yeah.
And that apparently the book has several chapters before he actually gets on a bus.
I think they're in Texas for like a third of the book.
Exactly. And so there is a lot of work that that bus ride has to do. Mm-hmm. And in the hands of a director like John Schlesinger, it's I feel like, I don't know, man, it's just really, really well done. He accomplishes so much with very little and leaves you with a lot of questions, but also with a lot to think about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like there were some moments in this where the like economy of images on the screen reminded me of another movie we recently discussed, The Silence of the Lambs.
For sure.
Okay. Just, you know, in Best Picture winners having these very like efficiently told moments of visual storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Yeah. I think Midnight Cowboy is just like, it's some of my favorite visual storytelling ever is in this movie.
I would totally agree with you. You know, this, John Schlesinger too. I mean, some of the earlier films, I talked a little bit about Billy Liar and, mm-hmm. Darling and, to a lesser extent, Far From the Madding Crowd, but those two other films, I think, Billy Liar and Darling are really interesting movies to watch. I would highly recommend to anybody to check them out. They were films that he made in Britain, and they were kind of from this sort of kitchen sink new wave era where there were a lot of films that were addressing very directly the kind of issues that sort of younger people were dealing with. In cities, in urban areas. You know, he is, even in those films, I think, really shows you a lot of his pitches. Like, there's a lot in his bag when it comes to, like, how he tries to present, like, sort of inner thoughts on screen. Mm-hmm. If you watch Billy Liar, so Billy Liar and Midnight Cowboy, the character of Billy and the character of Joe Buck, those two films are extremely similar. Hmm. You know, Billy Liar, like obviously, you know, by his name, he's a compulsive liar. But you know, there are two stories about, you know, young men who really feel at odds with where they grew up. And like where they're like, you know, what their home life was like. And they feel like something is out there that they're destined for, but they just cannot get out of their own way. Mm-hmm. And so you see a lot of really similar techniques, storytelling techniques, visual techniques between Midnight Cowboy and Billy Liar. You know, the thing too that I just love about John Schlesinger is that I think, you know, it's really clear that, you know, he has a really good command of like formal filmmaking. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think like the blocking is really good, you know, like camera movement, like long shots to establish like characters in a larger setting, you know, close-ups to can like better convey emotion. You know, there are a lot of those things that are there, but he really blends it with like this like almost like athletic sort of camera work. There's a lot of flair in the film, you know, a lot of techniques that really feel ahead of their time.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
You know, there's like, we talked about, you know, that, you know, kind of whip pan, but there are a lot of like quick cuts. There are a lot of dissolves too. There's that really beautiful one where right before he gets on the bus, he looks in that, the window and he envisions himself kind of as a young boy. And it's like, there's a lot of those that are really neat that just kind of really position, you know, a character in the present, but also in the past.
And like a really smooth transitions also in an era where film editing was a very different process.
Totally.
Like, I think about that, the scene with that goes like from day to night as he's walking down the street, which is just going to be seared into my brain. I love that. And like to get that so clean was like not nearly as easy as it would be doing it now.
Totally. 100%. Yeah. I mean, and I feel like you see so many examples of that, you know, throughout the film, you know, there's a lot of double exposure. I think that also happens in this, some like kind of changing frame rate stuff that happens, especially, you know, later. There's like different film stock. It like it goes from black and white to color as well. It's just, it's such like a, it's like an acrobatic film, like really to watch. There's so much visually that's happening. And I really think this is the movie where it really comes together, but I would highly recommend Billy Liar and Darling. I think both of those movies are really set the table really nicely for watching this film and really appreciating just how capable of a technical filmmaker John Schlesinger really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And didn't he start in documentary too?
I believe.
I think that. I've read that. Yeah. Because
there's like a couple moments here that I thought like really struck me for their realism as well.
Sure.
And one, it's not, you know, completely realistic. It's definitely a craft moment, but a crafted moment. But there's, I think, during the first montage when the theme music plays, and this is not Everybody's Talking. This is the theme from Midnight Cowboy by John Barry. There's a moment where you see this. I think it's kind of that Joe Buck is envisioning these other images of Midnight Cowboys walking on the streets, and you see it's like a couple people occupying roughly the same like physical frame. Just, you know, it goes through jump cuts through a few, like four different men.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I remember this really well too.
Yeah. All occupying the same frame. And that felt like struck me as a very documentary moment.
Totally. Yeah. I'll say too, you know, to that scene as well, tying back a little bit to, I think maybe what a psychiatrist who petitioned for an X rating for this film. One of the other, I think, notable characteristics with John Schlesinger is he was a gay man, and he was somebody who, and you can see it too, I think more in Darling than in Billy Liar, but he directly references, I think, homosexuality in his films, and is really not afraid to put it out there.
Yeah.
And I think that actually is a general trait, I think, through a lot of his films. You know?
And I also, if I remember hearing that he came out kind of later in life, and I think during the production of this movie is when he goes out publicly.
Yeah. And he was not a spring chicken. I think he was in his mid-40s when he did this film. So
Yeah.
But I mean, still, I mean, still in the late 60s, early 70s to come out, I think is pretty rare, pretty brave thing to do.
In researching for this conversation, I also watched this recent documentary called Desperate Souls, Dark City and the Legend of Midnight Cowboy, which it came out just like 6 months ago, and it showed at the Film Forum, which is where I initially saw it. But I rewatched it for now. And there's a really interesting section of that movie that talks about its representation of sexuality.
Yeah.
That it also talks about the biographical details of Schlesinger's life that was part of the draw to the story for him, was what he saw of himself in it.
Absolutely.
And that the cowboy has been, even if in like a, you know, subcultural way, kind of like a prominent gay symbol for a while.
Yeah.
It's by the time the movie comes out.
It's kind of been reappropriated, I think. And you see it happening in the film. Rico's character.
Yeah.
Very explicitly states that, you know, that the kind of the imagery of a cowboy is
only appeals to gay men.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, using some less charitable terms than we are now. But also that at this time, this is another thing that comes from that I'm drawing from that documentary, that, you know, like that being gay is still seen as like legally it's a criminal offense in the United States and in the UK where Schlesinger is from. And it's also like seen clinically as like a condition, a disease that's curable. And I mean, you know, by today's standards, that really feels like a very evil way to look at things.
Yeah.
But at the time that the movie's coming out, that's part of what makes it so revolutionary, is that this is a time when like coming out is a much dicier thing. You know, it's like there are open secrets. Like I think in Oscar Wars, it said that Schlesinger's sexuality was an open secret, but, you know, it's risky to acknowledge it point blank.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah.
And kind of fittingly, in Midnight Cowboy, I think when I first heard of it, like I was, you know, introduced to it being like an LGBTQIA+ movie. And so going in, I thought like, okay, so like the characters in this are going to be presented as gay or something else in kind of an unambiguous way, but no, it's pretty ambiguous. I mean, it's definitely hinted at, but it doesn't really give you, to use a you know, a contradictory pun, a straight answer.
You know, I it's interesting too, because, you know, to the point that you just said, there's one little detail I remember when Joe Buck and Rizzo, they go to that party, and he's already very sick. And they're in the stairwell, and he's like, "Man, you're really sweaty." And he takes the edge of his shirt.
That's and such just, a beautiful and moment.
It is. It's a very beautiful moment. And there's a moment where I think, you know, Rizzo's character is clearly very sick, but he kind of leans in and almost sort of like kind of holds Joe in a very familiar manner.
Yeah.
But like, even that moment to me, I think can be really read as just like, this guy is incredibly lonely and, mm-hmm. and is incredibly yeah. scared.
And this is like really the only person he has in the whole world.
Yeah. Who's like, who's even looking out for him in the smallest of ways. Mm. And I think that's one of the things too, that's kind of interesting. And one of the reasons why this movie, I think, had the mainstream appeal is you look at those characters and I think there's a way to read it where you could maybe think a little bit that it's maybe a story about you know, love between two men. Mm-hmm. But there's also just intimacy between them that starts to grow. Yeah. That like these are two guys who for whatever reason like don't have anybody else. And yeah. they have each other. And that there's something oddly very beautiful, and it doesn't have to necessarily be like sexual in nature. Mm-hmm. It's really just like it's just they have each other.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like whether or not you look at their, like whether or not you agree with there being some sort of like implied attraction between them, which I don't necessarily read, there is like a closeness, there's an intimacy, yeah, between the two of them. And it's sort of like, it makes me think about the way that we present like male friendships, where it's mm-hmm. like, if these were two women that like one was sort of like helping another one like dry off what, like her sweat when she's sick, I don't think we would so immediately jump to like they're in a sexual relationship.
Totally.
But because we sort of present like, you know, if there's physical touch between men, like perhaps that implies something deeper. But I actually just think it can also be like the beauty of a platonic close male friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think in a lot of ways though, this is a, you know, this is something that translates mostly into comedies in the years after. I think Midnight Cowboy is a great example of the buddy movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting one for yeah. sure. You know, I mean, like we alluded to, there are a lot of layers to it.
Yeah. It's a funny movie at many points, but it's, you know, you wouldn't really think to call it a comedy.
Yeah.
Getting more into, like, I think once Joe Buck gets to New York, it's a little easier to describe the plot in a less like, you know, one by one way. And it's more like a series of things that, you know, happen and keep on happening.
Yeah. It's such a slice of life movie. Yeah. It's a lot of vignettes kind of,
yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah. Like chapters that are united by a theme.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. One interesting anecdote, I can't remember where I heard this from, but I remember in hearing a story of the famous "I'm walking here" scene, that is one of like the most genuinely improvised moments in film. Like there's a lot of famous moments that are noted in classic films for being improvised, but there's some caveat like improvised in a rehearsal or something like that. Like Joe Pesci's, you know, like "I'm funny how I amuse you" in Goodfellas, like,
yeah.
That was improvised in a rehearsal.
Mm.
I'm not sure, but I think that here's Johnny in The Shining, it might have been the same thing,
mm-hmm.
but that this was genuinely of the moment.
So this is debated.
Okay,
this
it's debated.
Yeah, this yeah. is not fact. So Dustin Hoffman absolutely is like, "I improvised this." We were doing a bunch of takes because we had to get the light just right, like at when the light changes for them to cross the street, and then this cab almost hits us, and he improvised that. Like he maintains this to this day. He has told this story many times. Schlesinger has said, "That's not how I remember it." so he's on record saying like, "No, we had a stunt driver. Like this was planned." And so who to believe? It's been 50 years. Like who knows which of these stories is true, but I find it so interesting that Schlesinger and Hoffman like have both told conflicting accounts of this. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely in Hoffman's, you know,
best interest.
It's in his best interest, you know, to build up his already very storied legacy.
Yeah. To be like, "Oh, one of the like most quoted movie lines ever, I just like came up with on the fly while almost being killed."
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, when you watch it on screen, it is a little more believable as a viewer to think that that really was of the moment.
Yeah. I you know what, though? I love the little detail that comes after, which is he goes, you know, that's a great way to pick up money and insurance. Yeah. I don't know that, like, that's the, and I think that also speaks to just the general, like, his character feels so lived in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Really, really, I mean, physically too. I mean,
that's sweat. Oh my God.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, the credit of everybody working on it, I mean, like, that is, he is grungy AF in this movie, and it really, really comes through the screen. Yeah. But he also, like, the other moment of his, I love this moment when he swipes the reservation from the actual gentleman caller.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty slick.
Oh yeah. I was like, oh wow. Even the way he like asks for the quarter afterwards, like to kind of throw the guy off, and then is like, nah, like at the cab. I was like, oh yeah, I like see this guy every day. Yeah.
Oh no. But like it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, totally.
I was kind of rooting for him when it happened. I was like, you go, man.
Yeah. I was like, oh wow, no, he's genuinely good at this.
Yeah. So I mean, it's a very lived-in performance, you know, and you really feel it all over.
I really like his little mannerisms. Like, he's constantly, you can't hear me do this, but he's like constantly like, or I think it's like an overbite. He like bites his lip a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's like, again, those teeth.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Those enviable teeth.
Yeah. And then like, well, also, I mean, it's funny how the I'm walking here scene, it's so iconic a line, but it's kind of like, kind of doesn't have to do with anything else that's happening.
Oh, definitely.
That's, I'd say, most of this movie.
Yeah. And, but then like, you know, what he's describing in that scene is this, I guess, basically a pimp that he's suggesting that Joe Buck goes to, named O'Daniel. Mm-hmm. And in that scene where he actually goes to visit O'Daniel, thinking that he's going to, you know, at first just be...
He has management.
Employed by him, but then he's propositioned on the spot. And then Joe Buck, he runs away scared. And, you know, like I didn't see that coming. And you start to really get a glimpse at his trauma then. It's like, I think the first time you see one of those, like, rapidly cut montages of...
The violence that he suffered.
Yeah, the violence that he suffered in black and white, which is mainly, I mean, and it's interspersed with a lot of things, but it's mainly this gang rape that occurred to him and Crazy Ann, and when they were both making out in a car.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, that's one of those things about this movie that I think even years and years after its release, it still hits very hard when you watch it today.
Oh, for definitely. Sure. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't... It shows a lot while not showing that much. It shows just enough to like really let your imagination like fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Again, a very like impressionistic, I think. I think about that word a lot when I think about just these little details that just kind of keep popping up throughout the film. They find a way of, you know, sitting with you and staying with you, and you start to formulate an opinion about it, and it starts to color the movie one way, and then maybe if you see it again, it hits you a little differently. And
and it's not long after that scene that was like, for a moment there, Joe Buck and Rizzo they're broken up.
They're separated.
Yeah. And in that time,
because Rico's just trying to scam him and like peace out.
And in that time, Joe Buck has that famous encounter with the Bob Balaban character in the movie theater. True. And that, I think, you know, the word about that scene is that that is the reason for the X rating, that scene.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty suggestive moment. Yeah.
It doesn't show that much.
No. Yeah. But I think, you know, by today's standards, it feels very, very tame. But you even kind of feel it. I mean, to the credit of John Voight, you can really feel in his mind, like his dignity just evaporate from his face as it's happening. And I mean, it's a pretty powerful scene.
Yeah. And that scene too, it's like one of the great ambiguous moments regarding his sexuality.
Uh-huh.
Cause we know that, you know, this thing is happening here, but then, you know, he is having these flashes of Crazy Ann in his mind as that's happening. And I'm sort of wondering, well, is he like thinking of that to perform?
Yeah.
That occurred to me as well.
Yeah. It's not completely clear, but then also, I mean, even before any of that's happening, I mean, he and the Bob Balaban character clock each other on the street, and maybe there's just some kind of attraction in that moment too. Maybe it's not completely, I mean, it is transactional, but maybe that's not the only thing it is for Joe Buck.
Right. Well, there's another scene later where Joe Buck has some issues performing.
Yeah. With a woman this time.
Exactly. And oddly enough, it's her
implying or
goading him a little bit that he might actually be gay, that almost sort of riles him up and gets
him.
Yeah,
he has to
really
prove
upset.
Himself.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's weird. Yeah, you know, to the point you made there, I think it's always kind of hanging. It's hanging there. It's hanging in our consciousness.
Because even from the very beginning, when he's talking to like the other dishwasher, who I really like, and the very brief moment we see him at the very beginning at the diner, he's telling him like, I'm going to New York, and like, oh, there's all these rich ladies, and there's also like, I'm not going to use the phrasing that he uses, but like, oh, there's like also men there who are attracted to men. Like he seems kind of open to this as he's planning his life as like a New York gigolo.
Right. Well, I think in that scene, I might be wrong, but I think one of the reasons he brings it up is he's like, you know, the numbers are on my side.
Exactly.
Is
That's
that like,
how I interpret
there are a lot
it.
Of women and there are not a lot of men who are interested in these
That's
women.
True. Yeah.
And so
I also think it can be kind of like a numbers game, and that like, oh, and then there's even more people who are attracted to men.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily read that necessarily as him saying he's attracted to men, but perhaps that he's open to it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
If in a transactional way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you talked about, Julian, you talked about the trauma, how as the movie unfolds, you really start to see that behind his kind of Southern gentleman, kind of good old boy exterior, that there's some real pain that he's dealing with, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even with those mirror scenes, you know, that, you know, there are moments where he's looking in the mirror and he's kind of, you know, winking at himself and kind of
flexing
a little bit and kind of propping himself up. But then there are also scenes where it's like he's trying his best to sort of get control in situations where he feels like he doesn't have any.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, I think, does start to bubble up the more he has to replay or kind of like relive his trauma.
Yeah. I think this movie is really great at conveying like the experience of intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
Like whether it's on that initial bus sequence, and it's not that, you know, the thoughts there are that intrusive, but just the experience of a wandering mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like whether it's there or it's in these trauma flashbacks too, it's just like the way that it keeps going back and forth between what he remembers and what he's experiencing in that moment.
Exactly. It's like very frenetic, I think. And I kind of interpreted it in some ways as like he's trying to repress these thoughts. That's why it like never lingers on something for too long. And it's like constantly interspersed with fantasies or with, you know, what's happening in the moment or whatever.
I had a quick question.
Yeah.
We've been talking this movie up. I feel like we all
feel
like this is a really, really exceptional work.
Great movie.
Yeah. There's one moment in this movie that I just feel like it didn't quite get handled with the kind of care that most of the rest of this film seems to have, which is the sort of psychedelic party.
Interesting.
I don't know why, but like it's really I feel like the moment where the kind of desire to kind of hit all of your senses with all of this, that it just seems to, it's conveyed well, but I don't really know to what end. And that's like the only scene in this movie that actually pulls me out of it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it comes back very strong once he leaves with her. There are a few very, very, I think, intentional and great details that bring you back to the core of the film, but there's like a good 8-minute stretch where like it gets very weird, and I still don't quite understand or agree that it really helps the movie. I think it could have been like 2 minutes or something. And instead it's a lot longer, and I don't really know what it does aside from the fact of, you know, maybe kind of showing you, you know, a type of kind of subculture in New York.
Well, to make an argument in its favor that actually connects to what we were just talking about, maybe it's just to show a fuller spectrum of Joe Buck's inner mind, and also an inner mind that is affected by mind-altering substances. that it's just kind of like maybe he is seeking out this pleasure as like a way of dealing with trauma. Yeah.
I mean, okay. He also, I think he feels that he's been chosen. Like this is also like a way of him like
feeling validated.
Exactly. Validating himself because he feels that he's been chosen to attend this party. And even when he arrives, he's like, we should tell somebody I'm here.
He also really does feel a little bit like a fish out of water. Both of them do.
Oh yeah.
Which is intentional. Yeah,
oh, sure. Certainly. But I think, you know, his curiosity is, you know, the overriding trait here.
And this is like this party could have been a turning point for him. Like, yes, as you say it, like this, you were saying you feel like it picks back up once he leaves with the girl. And I mean, we kind of started to talk about how, yes, it starts off, he has like some issues performing, but it ends up very well to the point that like she refers him to like another friend.
Right.
And then
exactly.
Suddenly this is like his idea, his fantasy of becoming this like, you know, New York male escort, like, oh, it's got some gas now. Like he could be moving down this road. Until something really terrible happens to the like one person that he cares about.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, I mean, and I mean, there's a scene that really pulls you back in and it's that scene where he like falls down the stairs after he's kind of worked up the kind of manager act and he's like, you know, I need my cab fare and everything and everything. But yeah, there's that scene. It's really beautifully acted. Like he falls down the stairs ostensibly because he's not well.
He can't walk. But, and they're like, he fell.
Yeah. I love that scene where the lady, she says, you know, hey fella, you fell. And she turns to Joe Buck and he goes, is he all right? And Rico answers in the third person. He goes, yeah, he's fine. And there's this like almost just like dejected, like he's just totally, unfortunately, you know, has nothing to do but accept the fact that that's where he's at. And it's again it's kind of heartbreaking, and it, to your point, it's something starts happening to the one person that he cares about, the one guy who he can't, you know, extricate himself from.
You can see like a brief flash of like reluctance to go.
And
but also like to say something more about Rizzo, like being, well, you know, it's sort of about him being in this state, but just also about the visual storytelling of the movie, that before this party scene happens, there's a scene around the middle of the movie when Rizzo is having this fantasy of his own out on the sidewalk of just imagining the two. I mean, you know, they already kind of are best friends, but imagining them being in Florida together, being like the life of the party at some beachside resort.
Yeah, and he doesn't have a limp. He runs freely on the beach.
He runs faster than Joe. Like Joe's running down the beach and then Rico gets up and runs with him and past him.
Because
he's like, this guy has a full foot on me, but in my fantasy, my legs are twice as long.
And it's just, I think that's the one time you really get a look into Rizzo's mind. And you see there's some very similar stuff going on there in terms of the fantasies that he has.
I mean, one thing that I was thinking about is that, you know, Joe has this fantasy of New York, and then Rico, who's in New York, has this fantasy of Florida. And that is absolutely true. Again, growing up in North Carolina, I don't think I'd ever met a person who was like, I want to move to Florida. Like when you live in the South, Florida's a punchline. And I mean, I guess everywhere Florida is a punchline, but particularly when you're in the South. And moving to New York, I was shocked at the number of people I talked to who are like, yeah, one day I want to move to Florida. Like, I feel like I talk to people that say that a lot, and that's not something I'd ever experienced before. So I actually think it is like, that seems pretty accurate that somebody who was really down on their luck here in New York is like fantasizing about Florida, or somebody who was down on their luck in the middle of like bum Texas, then like, they're fantasizing about New York. Like every grass is always greener, like no matter where you are.
No, you're right that like, that scene is, I think, one of the few moments where the kind of the filmic techniques of kind of visually showing you what's going on in the mind of a character is afforded also to Rico.
And it's intercut with just the shot of him on the street where I think just Hoffman holds like a really good close up. And that's where he's got like that lip biting thing yeah. that I noticed.
I love because in that scene, it totally it starts to flip.
Yeah.
Joe mm-hmm. Buck, obviously, you know, he doesn't have the goods to pull it off.
Yeah.
And so even in
the fantasy,
it starts to turn.
Devolve.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it devolves very quickly. And when Joe finally gets thrown out in the street, I love, and I mean, we were talking about the very beginning of the film, you know, we see just that the drive-in screen totally empty.
Yeah.
There's a really also great shot, which is just the neon flashing sun,
yeah.
which is kind of that last very impressionistic, I'll keep saying it, mm-hmm. image of that, like the only like kind of Florida sunshine that Rico is going to really get is yeah. from like a neon lights in Times Square.
And like yeah. the posters and his like hole in the wall.
Exactly.
Apartment.
Yeah. This whole time, once Rizzo offers Joe Buck a place to stay, they are living in squalor.
Oh yeah.
Definition.
Yeah. They're squatting.
In this condemned building that, I mean, it's like, you know, Rico talks it up and says, like, I got my own private entrance, but like...
it's like climbing through a hole in a fence.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, watch the plank down there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and it's just, like, I feel like every scene filmed in that environment, I mean, on the one hand, it's like, it's gut-wrenching to watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's terrible to imagine yourself living in it, but it's very well portrayed, I think.
Particularly once, like, when the first day they get there, when we first see it, he's like, oh, there's no heat, but I'll be in Florida by the time winter comes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then winter comes, and it snows, they're and you see the there. Pipes frozen, and yeah. that is when it's really just, like, rock bottom.
Yeah. And then Joe Buck has to pawn his beloved radio in order for
him
to get
that was so
money.
Sad.
Yeah. That's another thing, too, is that this movie is full of visual motifs, not just the mirrors, but also with like consumer products.
Oh man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That crazy thing for the dogs on TV.
Oh yeah. My God.
Yeah. I actually thought that's aged incredibly well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that scene where, you know, he's in his first tryst, where Joe Buck's in his first tryst of the movie, and they're like bumping the remote and the channels are flipping. I mean, it kind of matches. It kind of matches like the cadence of his thoughts too.
Yeah, or you know, I mean, Joe Buck is a young guy in the yeah. late 60s. It's very possible he grew up on television.
I think we actually yeah. see evidence of this in yeah. some of his flashbacks.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So it's you know, to your point, that's actually a really good comparison.
Julian,
yeah.
did you notice the Garmanbozia?
Yes, I did. Yeah. yeah. So this is a Twin Peaks reference.
Okay. I was going to say, I was like, yeah. I didn't.
Yeah, it's just like among all those visual motifs. So the consumer products, there is that Mutual of New York.
Yeah.
Shows up building
times. Money.
Yeah, yeah. Money. Yeah. yeah. He puts that word in scribbage with the Brenda Vaccaro character later on. And then, I mean, we've already talked a bit about it, but clothing in the movie. I remember the first time I watched it years ago, I noticed quite a preponderance of shoes in it. I mean, I think the scene that really stood out to me, or maybe there were two, was the first one being when Rico is doing an impromptu shoe shine.
Oh,
in the
I
subway.
Love that scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a small, short scene, but I love it. All right, continue. Yeah.
But that scene is one, and the other is in the very end when they stop in Florida and Joe is buying some new clothes, and among them, I think he throws out the old cowboy boots that he had.
He puts them in the garbage.
Yeah, yep. he's shedding the image. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in that last sequence where they finally just like they realize that Rico's so unwell that if they want to get him to Florida, they have to do it now.
Yeah, time's up.
Yeah, yeah. Just it, like you really feel that race against time there.
Man, that scene is really heartbreaking too, where he's on the bus and he's like, yeah. please, whatever you do, don't call me Ratso.
Yeah. yeah.
He's like please.
We're like, we're going to meet some new people and yep. I'm not putting up with this.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. But he's like, it's almost like this all is for naught if I show up at this new place and I can't
I'm
shed
like the
my
same
old self.
Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I noticed too, like there's all these moments throughout the movie where like Joe is making these, you know, playful comments to roast Rico and he's not laughing. But the only point when he really laughs is like in the like almost at the very end when they're on the bus and Rico admits that he's soiled himself in the seat. And then, you know, he's like, why are you laughing? And he's just like, oh, you just took a rest stop that wasn't on the schedule.
right.
And that's the one point where like Rico
can
can't help
laugh.
Himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
and then, you know, really also just very well done. It's a nice little moment for about 5, 6, 7 seconds. But then, you know, the coughs kick back in.
Yeah.
And you're brought straight back to the reality that this dude is on death's door.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote in my notes, like, nobody told me this movie was going to break me. Like, I was just so broken at the end. Like, people are like, oh yeah, it's a great movie, it's a classic. Nobody's like, no, this will make you cry.
Yeah. I also think there's something too about the way that the bus driver is like, nothing to see here, folks. Nothing to see.
Yeah, like, well, we'll be in Miami soon.
Yeah.
Just a few more minutes.
Yeah, just like barely missed it. But
he did seemingly make it to Florida.
Right. That's true.
I don't think he got off the bus.
Yeah. I mean, if you're only a few minutes away from Miami by bus, you've been in Florida for a couple hours.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He got to see the palm trees out the window.
Yeah. And then, I mean, you know, that scene when Joe realizes that he's speaking to a corpse, like he's, sorry.
I'm so sad.
Yeah. It's,
No, it's rough. It's like really rough. And I think I never do well when people die with their eyes open.
Oh my God. Yeah. And even like the bus driver is like, do you want to close his eyes?
Yeah, exactly.
And Joe's like, what?
And then there's like one moment, it's very brief, but where you get a flashback in Joe's mind where you see him in an army outfit.
Yeah, that's true. He's like sitting on his grandmother's doorstep, seemingly after her death.
Yeah.
Gosh, this movie, man.
Yeah, and it
has so many, like, I completely forgot about that, but you're right. Like,
So there's a suggestion maybe he's been drafted.
Or maybe he's running away from Texas because he's like a draft dodger.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he'd have to go further.
Yeah, I think he
New
needs
York,
to keep going north.
Yeah, and this, I would think so too.
And this movie,
the bus a little longer.
I don't know. You know, he's not the smartest guy, so maybe, you know.
But this movie is made, you know, while the Vietnam War is happening too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's no acknowledgement or next to no acknowledgement of it in the movie itself. But, you know, for someone living at that time, you can't escape it.
Yeah.
And yeah, as we're drawing this conversation to a close, I just want to include a little more interesting history about the Oscars that year and the circumstances that led to this winning, which is that as this sea change is occurring, so, like, you know, obviously movies are being made differently in the late 60s and in the 1968 Oscars. Though Oliver wins Best Picture, there are these hints of the countercultural wave that's happening, where like Rosemary's Baby is nominated for a few things.
In the Heat of the Night?
That's the year before, but that too, alongside, like, nominated by Bonnie and Clyde as well. And then also in 1968, there's 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's like, which, you know, gets a like kind of a measly reception
at the time
at the Academy Awards specifically where it's like under nominated. The only thing it ever wins is for visual effects, the only Oscar ever given to a Kubrick movie.
Mm.
But also then Gregory Peck is the president of the Academy at this time. And, you know, he is kind of this individual symbol of both, you know, he's been a symbol of change before as Atticus Finch, but also, he's kind of struggling to stay relevant himself.
Sure.
And so he's, you know, trying to straddle the line as Academy president between, you know, acknowledging the industry that has existed and the one that's going to exist. And he receives a letter from a young Candace Bergen, who is observing the movies that are winning at the Oscars for the 68 movies. And she's thinking, this is not reflecting the times. And she makes a plea to him, you know, to change the body of Academy voters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
This moment of knowledge brought to you by Michael Shulman.
Yeah. So then Candace Bergen makes this plea. And then over the course of time, though this doesn't actually get accomplished until after Midnight Cowboy wins, Gregory Peck is trying to find a way to make the less relevant Academy members non-voters, the people who have not been active in the industry in 7 years or more. And he doesn't actualize that move until after the movie's won, but he was trying to find a way towards that the whole time. And then in the process, you know, some of the new people invited to the Academy include Jack Nicholson, Elliot Gould, Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper, Robert Forster, who had just been in Medium Cool at that time.
Oh, great movie.
Very underappreciated movie.
Yeah,
too.
Definitely.
But also that Dustin Hoffman, I think, had been invited and just didn't bother to respond. But that's kind of the landscape into which this Best Picture win happens. And I think, you know, like, as you look at the movies that win throughout the 70s afterward, I mean, there's still some other things that feel pretty progressive. I think there's this ongoing back and forth in the, like, the history of Best Picture winners between these really, like, progressive movies winning and things that feel more like safe conservative choices.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's been, what, 55 years since this movie came out. And I mean, we're still having this conversation in regards to the Academy Awards.
Right. Yeah. And the voting body.
Yeah.
And yeah, like what kind of films are being appreciated and celebrated. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a constant back and forth. Well, maybe that's a good segue into doing our little unlikely shared universe.
Oh man,
to finish this off.
I think we can do a few of those if
yeah.
we want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
go
yeah.
For all right,
it. I can sure. start. So Joe Buck, in his attempt to assert himself as a male gigolo in New York City, he comes across a young man who we've spoken about a little bit earlier, and this guy goes into a movie theater with him and. Under false pretenses, by the way, mm-hmm. he
scams him. He's also a bit of a hustler.
Exactly. Totally. You know, gets into the situation for himself, gets kind of scary for a moment for this young guy. And, but he makes it out alive pretty much mm-hmm. unscathed. But, you know, he's a young guy in New York City. And, it's very possible that this young guy was, you know, maybe studying medicine of some kind. It's possible. It's,
maybe,
you
we
know,
don't know.
Yeah, you don't really know, but it's very possible he was studying medicine. And it's also very possible that this guy's name was Arthur Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. And about 10 years later, Arthur Rosenberg happens to be working with a guy named Edward Jessup, who is a psychopathologist working for Columbia University, and they're studying schizophrenia together. It's very possible in 10 years' time. And the other thing, too, Edward Jessup, not a bad-looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very possible that Arthur maybe was, you know, making some moves to try to position himself close to, you know, a hunky, you know, a psychopathologist. It's very possible, but... I'm talking specifically about Bob Balaban and how he ends up in the movie Altered States. Have you guys seen Altered States?
No,
I have not.
Dude, Altered States, great movie. But Bob Balaban plays, this guy, Arthur Rosenberg,
yeah.
Who is friends with William Hurt, who we've talked about a little bit in our last episode.
Yeah.
Not afraid to take his shirt off. In this movie and in other films too. He does not have a name in Midnight Cowboy, which really opens
makes
things
the game
up.
Really easy.
Oh yeah, definitely. But seeing as, you know, he is a doctor in New York City.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. He didn't have to travel too far.
Exactly. Doesn't not have to like go too far for to this. Exactly.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson land.
Yeah. Bob Balaban is one of the great alliterated names.
I guess. Did I tell you guys my Bob Balaban story?
No.
Oh.
I'm talking a lot about my freshman year in college.
Very pivotal year for you.
I guess. But my freshman year, he came to speak at NYU.
Wow.
It was like one of these things you could sign up for. And it was like a Q&A. He was talking about something he was doing. And at the very end, they opened it up for questions, and I looked up Bob Balaban, and I found out that he grew up in Chicago, actually relatively close to where I grew up. And so I was chosen to ask a question. So I asked Bob Balaban a question, and it was something related to if there was anything in Chicago with him growing up that inspired him artistically mm-hmm. to want to kind of further pursue acting. And he had a response that to this day I still think about, and I cannot wrap my head around. I think I opened up like a traumatic wound because he paused for a long time, didn't speak for a while, and then said something to the effect of, "I have to admit, I wanted to do anything I could to get out of Chicago."
Oh.
And he was like, "I found it was a barren place for the arts, and I couldn't wait to get out of there." And then suddenly it was like, "And our Q&A is over. Thank you so much, Bob Balaban, for being here." Yeah. And so
you're like, no one else could have ended this.
Yeah.
Anyone else have a question?
Anybody else? Please. No, but it was shocking because I said it and it was like a solid 6 seconds of silence. And it was like something got over his face. And it was like, it was bizarre. I still don't know.
He's like, if I had wanted to talk about Chicago, I would have done this Q&A in Chicago.
Anyway, yeah, it was an interesting moment. Bob Balaban, if you're listening, I'm very sorry if I brought up some uncomfortable memories.
Yeah, and well, maybe his idea of getting out of Chicago was donning a cowboy costume and getting on a bus to New York.
Maybe. Could have been.
Maybe.
I don't know.
So Joe Buck, you know, much as we're convinced that's his name, it turns out to, you know, it kind of has a John Doe vibe to it. It turns out to have been a pseudonym this whole time.
Yeah. I was like, this is a fake name. Oh, yeah. Your grandmother, Sally Buck. Okay, whatever.
Yeah. So his real name is Ed Gentry. And so let's say that at the end of Midnight Cowboy, he just kind of stays on that bus and goes and settles in Atlanta next. And he alludes to doing some outdoors work in that final conversation with Rizzo. And so then he doesn't come to doing, you know, that as a job, but he becomes a businessman and makes some friends who decide to do a canoe trip
yes.
down a river that's about to be dammed. And, you know, they have some rather traumatizing adventures along the way.
Oh, I would say so for sure. Yeah. He also probably turned around and found a wife pretty quick.
Yeah.
Not very possible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Unlikely but not impossible. Well, I wanted to ask you guys what your first exposure to John Voight was, if you remember.
Oh, I think it was as a kid watching the first Mission Impossible movie.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I think mine was... it could have been that, honestly, but I think mine was Enemy of the State.
Okay.
He plays the big bad in that movie.
Okay.
I love Enemy of the State, by the way. Great Tony Scott movie.
All right. Mine is without a doubt Holes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And I almost feel if I'm like right in that sweet spot of like, I feel like I was like 10 when Holes came out. I was like the perfect age to see that movie. Like if you were in that, like if you're like 3 years younger or older than me, then I feel like you also saw Holes in the theater.
This is the second time we've talked about Holes on this podcast.
We have talked about Holes before, yes.
Yeah.
But I think about him in that. I haven't seen that movie in years. I can't remember exactly how he fits in. I think he's mainly in flashbacks, if I remember correctly. But yeah, that was most definitely my first exposure to him. And again, I think the first exposure of people within like 3 years on either side of my age.
Yeah.
Well,
guys, I think we did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a really, really good movie. I think we all would highly recommend.
Absolutely.
I think this is a time when the Academy got it right too.
I would say so as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now on the subject of the Academy getting it right,
yeah.
Let's talk maybe
right
a little
bit.
They don't always.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, I don't know, you know, maybe we'll watch these movies and feel differently, but the
point being that sometimes there are some upset winners, things that people do not expect to win that somehow do it.
Unique
for in that way. And so the next two movies we're going to be talking about for our two-shot segment are the pair of 2005's Crash.
Paul Haggis.
Directed by Paul Haggis. And 2018's Green Book.
Yes, by one of the Farrelly brothers.
Yes. And this is for, I think, all of us, maybe the first time we're going to be talking about some movies that individually we're not that excited about. But, you know, to consider what they say about the Oscars and the film industry at large, I think that'll be quite interesting.
I do think they will inspire some very interesting conversation.
Real quick, have you guys seen either of those films?
I have not.
Okay, I have seen
You've seen
of
both
them.
Of them.
And I saw both of them in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So I will have an interesting, I think, take on all this. But I'm actually really curious to hear what you guys think.
Yeah.
Particularly about Green Book. Particularly about Green Book. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, right. Listener, tune in to find out. In the meantime, if you want to follow us on Instagram, follow us at Sleepless Cinematic Pod. If you want to email us, sleeplesscinematicpod@gmail.com. If you want to follow myself or Madeline on Letterboxd, follow us at either at @Julian_Barthold or at @PatronessOfCats.
Yes.
Guys, thank you so much.
Thank
you.
We did it.
Thank you.
Midnight Cowboy.
At midnight.
Exactly. Good night. Oh.